then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's November the 13th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, I am somewhat, but not completely recovered from last week's crud, although I suspect I'll have to do a lot of editing this week in order to get rid of coughing spasms. I do have some more Mike Harris and Joe Adams show excerpts I can drop in if my voice starts to run down too much. Yeah, I know you guys consider that to be cheating, but I honestly don't know if I'll be able to bloviate on to any great extent this week. My lungs still feel like somebody put them through a cheese grater. I forgot to get my flu shot early this year, and this is probably the result. Next up, some housekeeping stuff. First, as incredibly reluctant as I am to do this, after I stated some weeks ago that I would not, I'm going to have to lay a little more secret squirrel on you. To the one remaining person among you who is still making CDs of these podcasts and sending them to me, for which I thank you very much indeed, and who is still apparently too raving paranoid to give me a name and an email address, which irritates the crap out of me, the following. Please do not just drop the naked CDs into cardboard envelopes and mail them. Some of them are coming in damaged and unplayable, and I think it may be because the post office is running your envelopes through some kind of squishing machine, and it is scratching the hell out of the discs. Please, go to Walmart or Best Buy and get a big pack of 250 or so paper sleeves for the CDs, and start putting the discs in those sleeves before you mail them. Secondly, the website Zazzle.com has now apparently decided to ban me from making those lovely tricolor postage stamps that you all admire so much when you get a letter from me using one. Now, someone has apparently pointed out to them that that pretty blue and white and green flag is wicked and racist and treasonable. Now, if some of you guys want to pay your party dues in the form of tricolor postage stamps or other tricolor and NF material of Zazzle.com, be my guest. That's ZAZZLE.com. I will be interested to see if they just flagged my account or if they have banned the tricolor as a whole. Now, if so, that'll be the first time that our national flag has been officially recognized by the enemy as a racist symbol, which I suppose is progress of a sort. Third, a number of you took my tirade of a couple of weeks ago to heart, and you have printed up some of those brochures that I was referring to, and they're on the way to me now. It sounds like we have enough coming in to where I can issue some to the rank and file for public distribution. Now, let me say that again, public distribution. By that, I do not mean passing them out among ourselves like kids with baseball trading cards, which is an illusion I know some of you won't get, since I doubt kids do trading cards anymore, if they even still make the things. I mean getting these brochures into the hands of muggles, to use the Harry Potter term. Non-awakened, non-racially aware, so-called, quote-unquote, normal people, although I admit that normal is almost impossible to quantify anymore. But you guys know what I mean. Joe Sixpack, Joe the Plumber, whatever you want to call them. I mean white people who are outside our wee little internet subculture. I mean preaching to somebody besides the choir. I mean getting the message of the Northwest Imperative into the white community as a whole, which is the pool from which we must draw our members in the future. If you will seriously make an effort to get these new brochures into the white community as a whole, then let me know and I will send you some, maybe a couple of dozen to start with. We still don't have enough for anything approaching a full-on public distribution, but with a couple of dozen you can target individuals through anonymous delivery of various kinds. Nothing wrong with that. No one expects you to jump up and down screaming, look at me, I'm a racist. Now, we do expect you to do something besides sit there and absorb things off the internet like some kind of silent sponge. Okay, my voice is starting to go already, so let's switch over to me and Joe Adams on November the 3rd, the day before Election Day.
If you want to get in on the conversation, 345, I'm sorry, geez, I messed it up, 857-232-0159, and the code is 345-925 if you want to hear what Harold has to say. Harold Covington, northwestfront.org. We had a nice conversation last week talking about the space madness in Ferguson, Missouri, but we have an election coming up on Tuesday, which I think is quite an interesting one, because while someone, oh, first let me say, hi, how are you, Harold?
Well, pretty good. Glad to be back.
Yes. For people like me and you, who probably are not going to be interested in the shows like Who Can Get Pregnant Before Their First Period and Mafia Wars, Fox News and things of that sort probably serve as our entertainment means. We all know it's BS and it's scripted, but it's interesting to just watch and observe. It's a form of entertainment, and it's only healthy if you take it strictly for what it is, entertainment. Now, let me ask you this. We have these elections coming up. We all know the flaccid Republicans are just, look, let's be honest here. They have no balls, Harold. They're not going to do anything. They're the party of white people, but not the party for white people. And if they would just be the party for white people, you know what? Fine. Use the liberal dog whistles, Harold. Be the party for working people. That even works for me. They would they would be the ruling people. But then again, absolute power corrupts absolutely. We know the deal with that. But what are we going to be looking for in this upcoming election?
Of course, prognostication is always a little bit tricky, but I should say at the very beginning, everything I'm going to say now is predicated on the assumption that the votes will be counted more or less honestly, and you can't really rely on that in the society anymore. But just for the sake of argument, we'll say that the votes are counted more or less honestly, and that the elections are an accurate reflection of the mood of the populace, so to speak. Okay, I think the Republicans will do well. I don't think that they will do as well as expected, because the simple fact is, Joe, that normal people, by which I mean white people with jobs and homes and some sense of responsibility and some sense of patriotism, et cetera, normal people are now outnumbered in this society. They are outnumbered by the blacks, the browns, the overwhelming wave of illegal aliens, many of whom will be voting in spite of all these voter ID laws. And unfortunately, and this is something we're going to have to deal with, we are now outnumbered in large part by a white underclass that has been deliberately created by the Democrats over the past 6 years, the foreclosed, the unemployed, the people who are reliant on things like food stamps, Section 8 housing, EBT cards, various Social Security disability checks, the various methods by which desperate and completely unemployed people obtain a government check. There are right now 92 million people in this country, adults, who are unemployed, and almost all of whom are getting some kind of government benefits.
And now, per capita, that's more than a third of the country.
Oh, yes. And so this is the classical method by which what was called demagogues back in the ancient times, and which leftist electoral parties always used to maintain their majorities. Basically, they buy votes with tax money. Some Scottish political philosopher said that democracy always ends when men find that they can vote themselves money from the public funds, and that's what basically has happened here. Basically, the Democrats are creating an artificial majority to the point where they probably won't even have to rig elections so much anymore, because the vast majority of the country is now dependent in some form or another on some kind of government handout. And every election, what's going to happen is Democrats going to go, no, don't vote for those evil Republicans. They're going to cut off your food stamps, and they're going to cut off your Social Security disability, and they're going to cut off your Medicare, your Obamacare, whatever. And in other words, by saying that the Republicans will threaten their benefits, which in a way they will, of course, and basically threaten them with the possibility of having to go back to work. And work is a habit, a cultural habit among people. When I was living in Britain and Ireland, I saw third-generation white welfare families, people that had no job, never had a job in their life, never expected to have a job, and there was no cultural requirement, no social pressure for them to get a job. What the Democrats have been doing for the past couple of generations is creating this, in essence, welfare underclass. Mostly non-white, but now a lot of whites as well.
But Harold, this is not sustainable. Only so much quantitative easing can sustain, number one, all right, fine. Where are the good jobs nowadays? Well, aside from the trades, the good jobs are with the government. You retire after 25 years. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, you have the best job of all, sitting on your fat ass all day collecting money from the government. Those are both contingent on having a working idea, funnily enough now, working underclass to support the system. That is not
exactly
indefinite.
Yeah, look, these people are evil and greedy and vicious. They're not very smart. Americans as a whole think 10 minutes ahead on a good day. You know it's unsustainable. I know it's unsustainable, but they have convinced themselves that it's not. I don't know if you're familiar with a guy named Paul Krugman, who is kind of the pet favorite economist of the liberal left in this country. Krugman basically says, yes, we can keep on doing this indefinitely. We can keep on making these big bond issues, borrowing money from the Federal Reserve to buy the bonds and pay off the earlier bonds, and then a couple of years down the road we do the same again, and that's how we finance our government. Of course, what Krugman forgets is the usury factor. This is how a national debt builds up into $20-30 trillion, whatever the hell it is now. I don't think anybody knows. But no, it is not sustainable. It won't work. You just can't keep on recycling the same money over and over again with smoke and mirrors. Somewhere there has to be factories making things. Somewhere there have to be people going to work every morning and actually doing the things that need to be done to keep society going. And there's going to be some kind of collapse. This may precipitate cataclysmic events in this country, but the present economy just simply is not sustainable. And I think right now we're all kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop, but the fact is that the Democrats, for the time being, are using this economic shell game to produce endless money, which they pull out of the air, Federal Reserve, and continue to pay the EBT cards and the welfare payments and the Social Security payments and the Medicare and the housing subsidies and so forth and so on, and the Obama phones and all this mess. Yeah. At some point in time, when the crash does come, the EBT cards, on the first of 1 month, for some reason, either through a computer glitch or because there just is no more money, all of a sudden millions and millions of EBT cards aren't going to get their direct deposits. Then is when we see the total breakdown of society, because those 92 million unemployed people all of a sudden going to have no money and no nothing.
Yeah, and they had a dry run with that a couple of years ago, if you remember,
Georgia,
at Walmart.
Yeah.
But hey, we get the point on this. Everybody understands. Let me ask you about this issue quickly of voter fraud. We know it's the case. I mean, let's be honest here. The Republicans do it as well. But the thing here is they're actually literally encouraging people to commit voter fraud, particularly in the black churches. We heard 2 weeks ago there was a report that came out. The NAACP was speaking before one of these congregations, and what they said was, hey, you know, make sure you file your, what do they call them, absentee ballots, because you don't need voter ID for that. Now you're going to have undoubtedly all these mestizos thinking they have the right to vote that have been coming here illegally. And of course, for some reason that you and I probably can't surmise, dead people vote as well. Is there anything, and if the answer is no, we'll leave it at that, but is there anything that we could do about this widespread voter fraud?
Well, there's a lot that we could do. There is nothing that we will do. Joe, this whole question of the past 50 years has not been whether the white man could do anything about it. We all know what we could do about it, and we could settle this thing in a couple of weeks, but we're not going to do that. And I won't get into any further details if you're listening, but the fact is that the states, a lot of the Republican-controlled states, are trying to do something about it. That's the purpose of these voter ID laws. I see nothing at all unreasonable that when you show up at a polling place to vote, that you show the registrar or whoever's sitting behind the little table there, that you just show them your driver's license and they check you off so that they know that, yes, you're really you, and you're not a repeater like they used to use in Chicago and Kansas City and all the, you know, the old Chicago saying vote early and often.
I'm even fine with the free ID.
This sort of stuff has been going
cards.
On for generations in this country.
Yeah. I mean, if the government wants to mandate ID cards, the hell with it. Fine, make them free. What does it cost? What's the overhead on the producing one ID card? Probably about the most $1.50. I mean, give me. I don't get it. But hey, let me ask you this. Shift gears a little bit from the actual election itself to something that I would like a brief lecture on. I was but a boy during the Clinton administration. I remember being a young chap, very young chap, mocking I did not have sex with that woman. Now, obviously, we have what we have in the White House. Another Democrat administration and probably, you know, of course, a non-white ruler of this country. But let me ask you this, Harold. During the 90s, and you ask any of these organizations, I haven't asked them, I've never spoken to them, but like the Southern Poverty Law Center or these other, you know, these moral superior watchdog organizations, they'll say that during the 90s, and I think it's evident that during the 90s, within recent memory, was one of the most booming times for some kind of racial collectivist movement. And that was probably before the internet. It's probably the last time you'll ever see anything like it because because of the internet. But and hey, look who's talking. I'm part of the problem. What I'm saying here, Harold, is
I'm always aware of the irony. I attack the internet all the time as to what it did to our movement, and I do it on the internet.
Yeah.
So you know, the irony does not escape me. Anyway, go ahead.
I'm no activist. I'm a talker and proud of it. But let me ask you this. What do you see as, if we can make a little bit of a verbal Venn diagram here, what do we see difference, you know, comparing and contrasting the years of Obama and the years of Clinton? How different was it back then than from when it is today? Because we talked about last week this growing consciousness, particularly around the whole Ferguson thing. What do you see as the similarities and the differences between the two periods?
Well, one thing, in the 90s, during the Clinton years, there was a booming economy, probably the last booming economy that this continent will ever experience.
And if I may ask, was he really that bad of a president, Bill Clinton?
He was... It's hard to describe. If I can digress, I wrote a novel called Slow Coming Dark. The subtitle of it is A Novel of the Age of Clinton. Clinton represented everything that is bad in the American character, and Hillary was even worse. Clinton himself was always kind of a buffoon. He was a glad-handing, good old boy Southern politician. He was almost a caricature of Boss Hogg. I think what bothered most normal people about the Clinton years was the hypocrisy that he brought out in the American left. I mean, here was a man sitting in the White House who was not only a quote-unquote womanizer, he was also an outright rapist. The Clintons were the first American presidential couple ever to have a generally accepted body count. People who opposed the Clintons in Arkansas and later on in Washington, D.C. had a tendency to end up dead. The Vince Foster case is only one example that you might remember. But
and, of course, now with Barry, you have all his former bugger buddies who turned up dead.
Yeah, the thing is that there was just something utterly, totally sleazy about the Clintons, and they weren't really all that bothering to conceal it. The Clintons represented the triumph of the 60s. One of the most intelligent things that I've ever heard commented about in the various political back and forth, and I can't even remember who said it, but what you have to bear in mind about American politics over the past 50 years is it's all about the 60s, who won the 60s. And unfortunately, we know who won the 60s. Mm-hmm. The Clintons were the ultimate flowering of the 60s, Hillary especially. And, you know, she was an Alinskyite and all that sort of stuff. But up until the Clintons came along, Americans were used to having a fairly staid, nice elderly white man in a suit in the Oval Office. And the, like, for instance, George Bush, I don't like a lot of what he did, but his family life appears to have been pretty normal. Kennedy, of course, was a mad, complete womanizer, but that was kept, you know, totally out of the public view. He was not open about it.
And people will argue that he was our last genuine American president. That's why he ended up.
I'm old enough to remember Kennedy, not really politically. And put it this way, if he had lived, he and his brothers would not have been good for the country. They would have established a dynasty basically before the Clintons and the Bushes did. But anyway, there was just something repugnant about Clinton. This is maybe this is just me being subjective. Americans...
Was it the last bastion of wholesomeness in America?
Well, it was when normalcy died. I'm not a Rush Limbaugh fan, but he came up with something that I think says it all. He said that Clinton remained popular as a president because he makes us feel good about our failings. Basically, he made mediocrity okay. It totally and utterly exposed the hypocrisy of the liberal left. Here was a man who was quite literally raping women like Paula Jones and Juanita Broderick and something like that. And all of the left-wing establishment feminists, almost all of whom, if you will look closely, are on some kind of government subsidy, they turned their back on these women and started deriding them as trailer trash and women with big hair and that sort of stuff. And you might say that the Clinton years were when the facade ended and we got a glimpse of who is really running American society. It's hard to describe, but I myself was just totally repulsed by everything that happened. I think my problem is that sometime back in junior high school, I must have had a really great civics teacher because I am still capable of outrage that this country doesn't work the way it should, that the wrong people are in power, and that the law has become totally perverted into an instrument of just simply generating money for lawyers, the whole thing. But I was used by then to, you know, government corruption, but even I was personally outraged by some of the things Clinton did. It's very hard to describe.
So how do we bring that to Obama now?
Very, very fortunate in that when he was in power, the country was kind of on cruise control, and we did have this big economic boom. I think if he had ever faced a real serious crisis, then things would have been a lot different.
So with Obama now, it seems as though we're looking at it, and mediocrity or just straight-out failure is superior to working. You know, you didn't build that. So that's interesting.
Obama's just the Peter principle of action. I assume you're familiar with that. Employees get promoted to their level of incompetence. Well, the thing about affirmative action is that it promotes people several levels beyond their level of incompetence, and so you get super incompetence, and that's what we have in Barack Hussein Obama. Actually, I think he's kind of almost a Manchurian candidate. It's pretty clear that there were factions of the Democratic Party that just pulled him out of the hat in 2007 because they were so scared that Hillary was going to get into power. I don't think Hillary is going to make it this time because she is hated by her own people. It's a long, involved story there, but
she's also pretty old. I mean, she's getting up there in age.
Let's see. For our first music break this week, I am in the mood for something utterly grandiose and pretentious. I know, the March of the Charioteers from the movie Ben-Hur. Yes, I know, the whole movie was riddled with Jews from top to bottom. So is our whole world, if you hadn't noticed. Now, if you don't like it, change it. Start by asking for some of those brochures I offered you and actually put them into the hands of white people outside our little charmed circle. Anyway, here it is.
comrades. Tonight I'm going to be reviewing Abir Taha's Cult of the Superman book, and of course, this is a thesis dealing with the meaning of Nietzsche, and apparently this is a book that is now required reading at a course being offered at King's College. Now, this is dealing with the three views of Nietzsche, and one of them being that he would have been totally against National Socialism had he lived to see that movement, and then the other being that he would have been completely for it, and of course, a view in the middle saying that he was somewhat for National Socialism. Those who claim that he had a rift or would have had a rift with National Socialism are people who are looking at only the popular aspect of National Socialism. And this writer is going to discuss the esoteric aspect. Now, of course, this writer is arguing that National Socialism is a supranationalist movement, and it's really a movement about race. It's a mythic biological belief. To understand Nietzsche, it's rather like understanding Rousseau and therefore having more insight into the French Revolution, or understanding Marx to better understand Lenin. Esoteric National Socialists were essentially neo-pagans. They believed that elites could commune with the inner light. And it talks about how Hitler was a pupil of this idea of theosophy. In theosophy, you read about intellectuals like Eckhart and Lebensfels. It also talks, this book talks about how Hitler felt a common spirit with ancient Greece. According to this book, and I'm sure this is true, the National Socialists were fascinated by Prometheus, the idea of stealing fire from the gods. And that's because they really wanted to take control of human evolution. Now, insofar as National Socialists were interested in Jesus to the extent that they were, there were some that believed that Jesus was an Essene, and they believed that the Essenes were Aryans. But they really did not like organized Christianity because they felt that organized Christianity was making Northern Europeans weak, and therefore they wanted to replace the cross with the swastika. And of course, rid Christianity, if it continued at all, of any Jewish elements. Now, the National Socialists were individuals with aristocratic values, and they were not anarchists, they were not amoralists. They believed that life was worthy and perfectible, and elites could gain self-mastery, and they could really become political soldiers or fighting monks. And of course, the goal was for these elites to cast off this idea of the slave morality, which was a morality of dissent or rebellion. And instead, because they are elite and because they have nothing to rebel against, their commanding would be obeying. And of course, they would do everything possible to attain their mission. Now, Western philosophy, of course, is rejected as non-elitist. And the author reminds us that both the National Socialists and also Nietzsche, they didn't believe in money and they didn't believe in a classless society. Nobility is not wealth or an inherited title. Instead, they wanted to restore the law of Manu. Now, this spiritual and biological nobility is recruited from all classes and indeed from other nations. And of course, there were many SS members who were non-Germans. As we also know, there were children who also recruited from other countries. And the writer reminds us that Nietzsche in Thus Sprach Zarathustra talks about these fugitives from many nations that would come together to create a new state, a new aristocracy, which would be the return of justice. And the book mentions the 1935 Nuremberg Law that gave German citizenship to people who were considered Aryan. Now, it is true that there were individuals such as Houston Stuart Chamberlain who were merciful to the racially questionable if they were of good spirit. But in the end, the finality or the ultimate desire of the National Socialists was of course, the coming of a Herrenvolk. And this would happen over the course of a 200-year program of racial improvement. Now, of course, the notions of National Socialism are to a certain degree stemming from Darwinism. And I'd just like to mention something that this author says about Darwinism. The author either has or attributes to Nietzsche a sort of pseudo-Darwinistic view of strong versus weak. Now, actually, Darwin is about how organisms adapt to their environment, and elitism is about how elites have or should have domain over beasts. There are many kinds of beasts, and of course, beasts can be physically strong. So if you think about it, for example, Brahmins may be certainly physically weak compared to a beast. And indeed, a very strong beast might also give Kshatriyas a run for their money. So I just wanted to clarify the difference between strong and weak and master and beast. And also, this author, for some reason, seems to use the term Nazi. Now, of course, many National Socialists would be offended by this. Now, granted, in its day, I think that it was sometimes a term of endearment if used privately. But of course, I just wanted to mention that. And also, this author, after writing a fairly stunning thesis about Nietzsche, seems to put out a final sentence which seems to backpedal. And this may be a desire to please the academic community. Now, I have been considering adding this book to my reading list, and perhaps I ought to, as it offers a functional, that is, a useful view of Nietzsche. Now, of course, this view can also be gained by reading Nietzsche, and of course, it can especially be gained when seen through the lens of his politically reliable sister, Elsbeth Foster Nietzsche, who wrote the introduction to at least some copies of Joyous Science. So if you can get a hold of one of those, or indeed read anything that she may have written, correspondence and so forth, you will be in good stead as far as having a functional view of Nietzsche. Now, of course, Nietzsche wrote in the late 1800s, and therefore his writing is rather flowery. And of course, people have different views of Nietzsche. And as with any intellectual commentary, I suppose it can depend on whose opinion you might be reading, since I'm sure various authors can make convincing cases. But of course, I always believe that at the end of the day, morale is the most important issue. So I hope you enjoyed this review. And of course, I have very fond memories of Nietzsche and, you know, reading his work. And since I've really been a fan since basically my late teens when I went on a Nietzsche reading binge. I'm sure that many people that listen to this show would find this book interesting. So thank you very much for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
Are we gonna do what they say can be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just like a bandit run. Keep your heart on the pedal, son, never mind them brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we gotta run to make.
Greetings, comrades. This is the Trucker coming at you from my alternate sound studio in the homeland. You might hear a little bit of background noise. That's the sound of northwest rain. And I'm enjoying an evening out in the hot tub after about 3 or so weeks on the road, hauling Reese's food products, Ben & Jerry's ice cream, and other refrigerated and frozen items back and forth across the country. Those of you that say you can't or are afraid to come up to the homeland because you don't think there'll be work. Well, guess what? I mean, everybody has to eat. Everybody has to wear clothes. They build houses, whatever. And how do you think this stuff magically gets there? Well, Scotty's no longer, unfortunately. So it has to come by truck because nobody else can operate the transporter. And there are always trucking jobs for those that can operate the equipment. It's not that hard. It does take a little bit of skill. They claim it's for an unskilled profession, but let's see one of these desk workers that claims this is a unskilled profession stick his ass behind the wheel of one of those 80,000-pound trucks and see how many light poles, cars, and pedestrians they take out. Because, trust me, it takes a bit of talent to operate one of these things. It's not for everybody. You need to figure out whether or not that it's for you, if you're so inclined. It's a nice life. It's not all roses and pink champagne by any means. You'll end up getting stuck at shippers and receivers, especially them damn grocery warehouses, for hours on end waiting for them to unload the trailer. Just as an example, the load I just got done delivering to Cisco in Kent, Washington from a cold storage warehouse down in the Las Vegas area, they had 4 boards. Basically 4 pallets of product on the trailer. That was it. They had that sucker down there at this cold storage warehouse loaded in like less than 5 minutes. It took the Cisco people, they had me in the dock door there for 3 hours and charged $100 lumper fee to unload 3 pallets, less than 5,000 pounds of product. So, if you're interested in making money and don't want to drive truck, well, there's always the back-breaking job of lumpers. And for 4 pallets, costing $100 is a little ridiculous, but hey, the trucking company pays it and then bills it back to the shipper. So, that's the way they play that there game. But, and the load before that, at the same warehouse that only, cold storage warehouse that only took 5 minutes to load this load, it took them most of the afternoon to get the load off the trailer, which would have normally taken them like 20 minutes maybe. But the driver we got the trailer from had dynamited his brakes for one reason or another. I don't know why, but somewhere back in Ohio, he stood on the brakes and tipped the product over. So there was like 7 or 8 pallets that they had to have temporaries come in, the lumpers, and restack it. So it took forever to get unloaded, it seemed like. But anyway, so that's just some of the things we have to go and put up with. Of course, if you get on with the better trucking companies, they will pay retention pay for that sitting time there in a situation like that. So anyways, comrades, I'm hoping to see some of your vehicles passing me. And this evening, it's a Wednesday evening up here, October 22nd. I just got done listening to the podcast, and I understand that some of my past tidbits and stuff were lost in a crash, so I guess I'm going to have to resend them. But I figured I'd go and at least get this out for one of the future podcasts. So, yes, it's a nice, wet, cool evening up here in the Northwest, and I'm enjoying the rain and the nice hot 102 degree hot tub here in my backyard. If you were up here, you could be enjoying it also, especially if you're in one of those droughted, blighted areas like California, Texas, pretty much the whole Midwest and stuff where they're having the drought and whatnot now. Anyway, yes, it's the wet season up here again, and the reason it's green and they call it the evergreen state, well, it's the ever-wet state, at least this time of year. We're getting quite a bit of rainfall, so, yep, it makes things grow, it helps keep the fire danger down, and it washes some of the unwanted people that came up here for the nice weather but can't stand the rain out of here. No skin off my nose, not a problem. I can deal with that. You just gotta slow down and take a little bit of extra time in the wet weather, and especially up here, you don't even want to be on the roads if it's snowing because of all the people that don't know how to drive in it, especially the locals. I'm talking the people who were born and raised up here in this area. They seem to think they can drive on snow and black ice like they drive on bare pavement, which is doesn't work too well. Okay, comrades. Hope to see you up here in the homeland soon. This is the Trucker signing off for yet another edition.
This is Mike Cross.
Mo Weevil said to the farmer, "You better treat me right. I'll eat up all your cotton, sleep in your grain ridge tonight." And don't you think of buying no farm machines. I'll eat up all your cotton, ain't buy no gas. Thank you.
Okay, guys, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to go ahead and lay another Mike Harris segment on you from the October 23rd show. I know this sounds like I'm phoning it in, as Gretchen says, but it's still necessary this week. I'm speaking now on Wednesday the 12th, and while I'm definitely on the downward slide to recovery, I still can't speak for any length of time without doubling up into convulsive coughing and without my voice sounding like it's being dragged over sandpaper. Now, you can actually hear in a few sections of this Mike Harris cut me coughing in the background since this show was recorded back in the last weeks of October when this crap was just starting to come on. Now, this happens to me roughly once every 18 months or so, and it generally takes about 2 weeks to run its course, although a little bit longer the older I get. I'm also hampered this year because, for medical reasons that I won't get into, I can't use almost any over-the-counter medications. No antihistamines, no decongestants, so forth and so on. Won't get into that because that verges onto Grandpa Simpson territory and nobody's interested. Anyway, here's me and Mike.
Good morning and welcome back. This is Mike Harris on Revolution Radio. Today is Thursday, October 23rd. It's 23rd. Oh, my goodness. The guest today is author and social engineer Harold Covington. Harold, welcome back. So anyway, I look at our issues here that we have problems. This country does. As a people, as citizens of the United States, we have problems. But I don't see a problem out there that can't be solved. I mean, we can solve them all. But what I do see is that we have obstacles. There are solutions to every problem out there. But we've got people in power and people who have vested interests in profiting off of our problems. And so they're never going to get any better. In fact, they're going to get worse because the bigger our problems are, the more money these people make. How do we get around this? I think we need to start calling some people out and be a little more aggressive, a little more strident, a little more pointed in our, quit being such gutless cowards. Let's call a spade, so to speak.
Well, there was an old saying about Confucius, and one of his disciples once came to him and says, "Master, what rule should we follow so that all may be right in the world? How can we make the world better?" In one simple rule. And Confucius replied, "In order for the world to be made right, all that is necessary is for everything to be called by its right name." This basically is the problem we have in any attempt at reform in the United States of America. We are not allowed to tell the truth. We are not allowed to call things by their right names. And the racial problem alone provides about 10 million examples of this. For example, if you were to look at the liberal media, you would still think that blacks were some kind of persecuted minority in this country, when in fact the absolute reverse is true. It is the white man who's now on the short end.
Yeah, they seem to be getting most favored. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the name of the radio show here, is the short end of the stick. That was part of my naming it, was that, because it is. It's time for our people to say enough of this nonsense. We need to take back what is rightfully ours. And however we do that, by whatever means, I think we're legitimate. Because one of the premises that I've been talking about for some time is that there has been an asymmetrical war waged against white America, particularly white American men. And it's time that we perhaps change the rules of engagement. Everybody in this country is hung up on this concept of due process. Well, you know, the bad guys don't give you due process. They certainly didn't give John F. Kennedy any due process when they murdered him, and they didn't give the people at the World Trade Center any due process when they blew that up. There's been so many political assassinations of people who show any leadership capability. Not only JFK, but his brother, Robert, was murdered. His son was murdered as well. Anybody who shows any leadership potential gets taken out. And so realize that we've been at war for over 50 years with these people, perhaps much more than, but perhaps much longer. It goes back to the Federal Reserve, many say. But and the question is if we're on a wartime footing, do we have the right to change the rules of engagement? Because there is no due process. The bad guys don't. Only the good guys use it. Only the American people insist on due process. But can we afford due process when they're taking our country and everything that we need to sustain ourselves and to keep ourselves alive as a people away from us?
No, due process, almost by definition, is what the people in power decide.
Due process is, yeah.
Because the people with the power decide what due process is. All I can say is that we're on a wartime footing and we're engaged in a war for racial survival, which I think we are. I think it's high time the white men started fighting. Up until now, it's been a pretty one-sided war. And this, in essence, is what my novels are about. There are five of them, and I urge all your readers to get hold of these novels because I describe exactly the situation that you're talking about right now. I describe the time white man decides to fight back, and I do not mean by tapping on a computer keyboard or yakking on a podcast or putting a bumper sticker on his car. Basically, there are certain situations where law and due process simply have to take a back seat to just to the realities of life. The reality is that in this country, for many, many years, there has been no law because it is not grounded in the consent of the governed. Basically, our present government, our present system, rules through one thing. It basically rules through the power of the guns on the hips of the police and the FBI, who enforce its will, and to some degree the military, etc. This is why, on my own show, I kind of tend to harp on various abuses and whatnot of the FBI and the assorted secret police agencies. Cops and FBI men and to some degree the military are absolutely central to our whole problem in this country because they are the ones who keep the present United States government in power. If Obama and the Democrats didn't have the guns on the hips of those cops and in the shoulder holsters of those FBI men, and if they didn't have the prisons, if they didn't have the courts, if they didn't have the machinery of coercion, they wouldn't last a week because they are not there legitimately. They are not there by the will of the people. They have no respect. They have no moral authority. It's basically America is ruled by naked force now. And so that type of situation generally, historically, means that only naked force can remove it. But we have reached that particular phase in our development. I know people who read my novels come to me and they say, well, Harold, we can't revolt. These people, they're the law. And I say, yeah, well, tyrants usually are. That's what makes them tyrants as opposed to ordinary run-of-the-mill gangsters. The only difference between George W. Bush and John Gotti was that John Gotti killed a lot fewer people and he dressed better. And so we are in a phase of what amounts to kleptocracy ruled by criminals right now, and the white man is morally justified in taking whatever steps are necessary to bring this to an end.
Well, you know, how do we know when a time? When is it time to take the safety off and begin to become more aggressive? What markers do we need to be looking for going on around us?
I personally think it was time many years ago, but we haven't done it because of our inability to organize, because of the character problem, which leads back to the liberal control of the culture for the past couple of generations. I think a large part of their culture war against the white man was not only to make us extinct by introducing feminism and homosexuality, etc., so white babies cease being born, that sort of stuff. A large part of it was aimed at keeping us confused, demoralized, ignorant, make us narcissistic, shorten our attention spans, dumbing us down to the point where not only are we more easily manipulated, but we are almost incapable of organizing in our own defense. Now, you mentioned all these people who are killed because they displayed leadership capacity. They have killed off the brains of an entire generation of young white people to make sure that no leaders will arise. I mean, I can tell you from having tried to do this myself for many years, trying to organize white people in their own racial interests is like pulling teeth. That's, I think, basically a large part of our problem is our inability to resist, and that's one of the reasons, again, that I wrote the books to try and show how it can be done.
Okay, well, I've read the books. I've read all five, and like between you and I, Harold, I've said this before, I'll say it again. They're fun books. I mean, there's action, there's romance, there's adventure, there's betrayal, there's espionage, there's everything is in these books, and they're really fun. And why don't we give the folks a plug as to where they can get a copy of them, and why don't we make some recommendations as to which ones you think they should read in what order. You can read them in any order because it covers, what, a 50, 80-year period or something?
Well, the last one, Freedom Sons, covers the first 50 years of the existence of the Northwest American Republic. First step is to go to northwestfront.org and check out the site, check out the Northwest Front. The novels themselves can be ordered from amazon.com or, and I know my friends all tear their hair when I say this, I will actually send you copies of the books for free in PDF format because I didn't write these books to make money. I wrote them to make a point. And if you don't mind reading a novel on your computer, then I'll be glad to send you free PDF copies.
Well, you sent me free PDF copies. I still have them on my computer. I've also got hard copies of each one, because you've been kind enough to send me autographed copies, which, you know, I have to say thank you for. But, you know, it really is. You know, we're at one of those critical times, and you articulated this earlier, Harold, where you said that it's going to happen soon. What do you think is going to happen? If you had to make some wild guesses, is the financial system going to collapse? Are the EBT cards going to fail? Is the permanent underclass going to rise up out of their ghettos and go nuts? What do you, you know,
okay,
what's your...
right now, if I just had to, based on like just today, October 23rd, I would say that there will be the midterm elections. The Republicans will increase their power, possibly to the point where they might get a Republican Senate. Now, regardless of the result of those elections, it's pretty clear that we're going to have executive amnesty in December before the next Congress comes in. As we've seen on Drudge Report and elsewhere, the government has already contracted out for 34 million new green cards. So we're going to get the executive amnesty. And by the beginning of 2015, the face of the country will be, in essence, changed forever. We will effectively become part of Latin America. And the question is then, what will the Republican Congress, which we may or may not have elected, actually do about it? The question is, will they impeach Obama? Now, it is possible that any attempt to impeach Obama would spark massive black rioting, and that would actually start the dominoes rolling. I personally don't think that's going to happen, because I don't think that even a Republican Congress, a fully Republican Congress, both the House and the Senate, would have the stones to impeach Obama. But we'll just have to see how that plays out. I mean, I'm just mentioning that as one possibility, and the rioting and civil unrest that would be caused by an attempt by the so-called white power structure, that's their term for it, to impeach the first black president, that might actually set off the type of rioting and stuff that could get out of control. When it happens, it will probably be something that nobody even notices for the first couple of days or first couple of weeks. But it's just going to, like, it's going to be like first little bit of snow that starts rolling downhill and starts picking up speed and picking up weight, and all of a sudden you got a big, huge
avalanche
coming down, an avalanche. Yeah. Again, there's always the old possibility that the EBT card system could fail. They keep pumping up the economy like a balloon with all these this quantitative easing and stuff. At any point, that could pop.
Well, let me give you some background on that. I read an article this week that it is costing the Federal Reserve $200 billion a quarter to keep the economy pumped up. And we have, at best, a stagnant economy. But it's costing them $200 billion a quarter. This is new money they're printing that they have to keep out there in circulation to keep this thing from collapsing on them. So that's a big one. I want to point something else out, because you've really touched on something here with this executive amnesty. Number one, that's not the way things are supposed to be done in this country. You know, I remember back in 86 when they passed the Simpson-Mazzoli Act. I was against that then. I said, if they do this, they're going to want another amnesty 10 years from now. Well, it took them 30. But we have another amnesty coming. Before that, all we had was deportation was the only option, and that should still be the only option. Let's get rid of these people. They don't belong here. They're taking jobs from the American people. But this was actually last week, Monday, October 13th, the New American magazine carried a new article. It's called The CFR Globalist Outline Strategy for the North American Community. And really what they want to do is that they're still hung up on this concept of destroying this country, making it into a North American union. With Canada and Mexico. And part of this amnesty strategy, this open, you can't leave the border the way it is. You just can't do it that way. But they do. And so now we've got 50, 55 million illegal aliens in this country. I don't think 34 is an accurate number. I think that's low. I think they're only printing 34 million cards because they don't want to print 50. People would be appalled. And so they want to keep it right at 10% of what the population, well, we're only adding 10% to the population. What are you complaining about? It's going to be double that. Because Simpson-Mazzoli, when they went after that, they said it would be only affect 800,000 illegals. Well, 3.2 million illegals took advantage of it. They were off by 400%. I think they're going to be off again by at least 100%. But this article in the New American Council for Foreign Relations wants to propose this. This has been on the agenda for a very, very long time.
Oh, yeah.
And it's time that we, the people, purged ourselves of these type. You know, the Council on Foreign Relations, that's a Rockefeller organization. That's an organ for their political will. It doesn't represent the best interest of the American people. It represents the best interest of the Rockefellers. And it's time for us, you know, us little people out here, to start flexing some muscle, because there's a lot more of us than there are of them. They just happen to have all the money. They've gotten that money through treachery, through deceit, through fraud, and it's time to get it back. And I think it's time that we kicked over the apple cart and broke some eggs, made a new omelet or something. We got to do something to make this right. It's past time. The only thing that I'm debating right now is what is the absolute best strategy. I mean, do we have to give up on this country now? Carol, I'm going to speak as a sure. devil's advocate here. I like your concept of the Northwest Republic. I'd like to see the whole country go that way. But I understand it's a crawl, walk, run. First, you have to have a territory. We have no territory now. But you look at the Mexicans in the La Raza group. They want the Southwest. They want that's their Aztlan. That's their new thing. They're not recognizing that piece of property down there was sold to the U.S. government. The treaty was signed. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was signed March 15, 1843. And the U.S. paid for that territory, paid $15 million in gold, and released Santa Anna and his army, didn't slaughter them, didn't intern them, didn't hold them for ransom, but released Santa Anna and his army and sent them back home. And that's how we got Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California. It was lost, and we negotiated a purchase of it. But they want it back now. They don't like the deal anymore after 170 years. So if we do go to the Northwest Republic, it only adds fuel to ceding the Southwest, just to ceding those territories. Well, I lived in Arizona almost my entire adult life. I don't want to see that go. I remember when I first got to Arizona in the early 1970s, that was a really nice place to be. It was a really nice place to be. It was a good quality of life, nice people, clean, affordable, good job prospect. But that's all changed. It's got a dirty, it's like Mexico. I mean, Phoenix, you drive through portions of Phoenix that are just, I'm sorry, they're scummy. It's like going down to
Central California is now effectively part of Mexico. Mike, it would be wonderful if we could bring back the days of the Brady Bunch and we were all 50 states from sea to shining sea and all that sort of stuff. But again, I have to tell you, we've got to stop looking back. Those days are gone now that we have God knows how many million non-white on this continent, I won't say in this country, include Canada. And among other things, we have to face up to the reality. What are we going to do with all those millions and millions and millions of non-whites? Are we going to kill them all? Are we going to chase them back south of the border with sticks and throw them on airplanes? I mean, really, we have to take this beyond the sort of debates that we have on Stormfront and on podcasts and on computer bulletin boards and this sort of stuff and try and think of something that can be done in the real world. In the real world, the white man no longer has any effective military force at his command. I think some of us have this idea that someday some nice guy in a suit's going to get elected as president and order the military to just clean up the situation and just run all these illegals out of the country and that sort of stuff. It's not going to happen because you look at the military nowadays, who comprises most of the rank and file? I've noticed that Obama recently, over the past few years, has been purging certain generals from the top leadership to make sure he has a more politically reliable military, which is one thing third world dictators do. But look, it's just not going to happen. The United States of America is going to break up as the Soviet Union broke up. This is going to happen whether we want it to or not. We can talk about it and discuss about it and debate about it until the cows come home, and then we're going to open our doors and look outside, and that's what's happening. The only thing that really we can do is to make sure that the white man gets a piece of the pie when it breaks up the reality of the situation. I would love to have the kind of world I grew up in back in the 60s and the 70s.
Well, Harold, we've got our top of the hour break. We'll be right back after this, and I've got some more discussion for you on this exact topic. So we'll be right back in a couple minutes, folks, more with author and social engineer Harold Covington. And get his books. Get his books. Don't be left out in the cold on this one. You can get one for free as long as you don't mind reading on the computer. They are exciting. They are fun. They're great reads. Be right back.
This is That Rarity, a folk song from World War II. This is Mickham and Clancy.
Farewell, ye banks of Sicily, fare ye well, ye valleys and shore. There's no Scot will mourn the loss of yet, all the poor soldiers are weary.
The piper is drowsy, his pipe's laid away. He won't be around for his vino today. The sky o'er Messina is heavy and grey, and all the poor soldiers are weary.
Farewell. Sicily, fare ye well, ye valleys and shores. There's no Scot will mourn the loss of ye, all the poor soldiers are weary.
Their drummer is dressed up all handsome and tall. His drums and his gear are laid by the wall. He's braced himself up for his photo and all, to take with his Lola, his dearie.
Then tune the pipes and sound the tenor drums. Gather your kit on the side of the wall. And tune your pipes and sound your tenor drums. All of our soldiers are weary. And fare ye well, ye banks of Sicily. Fare ye well, ye valleys and shores. There's no Scot will mourn the loss of ye. All of our soldiers are weary.
Right, I suppose some of you want to hear some comment from me about the elections, although maybe not. There seems to be an attitude among at least some of you out there that by speaking about real politics, and by that I mean the actual specific ways in which power is exercised in this society and by whom, I am somehow betraying some deep inner spiritual purity of our wonderful wee little movement, and I'm turning into Rush Limbaugh, and I'm selling out. Selling out for what, for God's sake? If I'm supposed to be a secret Republican false flag operator or whatever, I wish to hell somebody at the RNC would tell payroll so they can send me my checks. Now, the idea, as near as I can tell, is that rather than defile and contaminate ourselves with actual real politics, which might involve thinking and interacting with real people and real-world problems instead of nice, obedient machines that do what we tell them to and never back sass or shout at us or threaten us, we need to hunker down behind the comforting warm glow of our computer screens late at night and jabber at one another on Stormfront and VNN. We must endlessly maintain our wonderful ideological purity rather than dirty our hands with anything involving actual real politics that might turn out to be hard or maybe even a little dangerous to the point where people might find out about us and Mom and Dad might kick us out of the basement or take away our computer. Kind of like our version of all those wild-eyed, bearded lefty radicals who used to meet and argue in the coffee shops and sidewalk cafes in Vienna and Zurich and Paris before World War I, talking all kinds of left-wing, weirdy crap, including Lenin and Trotsky and that crew. Except those guys got some coffee and rolls in the cafes. All we get is bags of cheesy poofs to stuff our faces with in front of the keyboard while we maintain ourselves in a state of ideological purity. You know, Rush Limbaugh does come up with some interesting images at times. He describes how, for years, liberals and so-called progressives would sit in the faculty lounge in their ivy-covered halls of academe and describe to one another how they were going to save the world, and then along came the Democrats. And eventually, those idiotic ideas were out of the faculty lounge and running the country. Now, every now and then, I make a mild suggestion to the effect that since the dictatorship has created a white opposition party in people's minds for their own purposes, even if it's not true, we might want to maybe see if we can hitch a ride for part of the way, kind of like in judo, where you use the opponent's own weight and momentum against him. Now, seeing as how Adolf Hitler and his long brown columns marching by torchlight seem to be delaying their triumphant return from Valhalla, or however some of us have convinced themselves it's going to go down. Never mind, I'm just feeling feverish and crotchety. Now, to close on an upbeat note, in the past week I've been notified of two more new migrants to the homeland. I know of them both from the internet. They dropped out of contact for a while, and then I got emails from them saying, "Hey, Harold, here I am. Here's my new address. Can we get together sometime?" Hopefully, I'll be meeting both of them within the month. Yes, it's starting to happen like that. I say again, people, the mountain is starting to move. I'm not making this up. We are getting there. It's just way, 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 way too slow. But for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom.
Well, they fought for poor old Ireland, and full bitter was their